Hi, I'm Armin Alney, host of To the Point, produced at the nonprofit public radio station KCRW. We're going to start this podcast in just a few seconds. First, though, I just want to ask you for a little support, because in order to be comprehensive, we have to talk to people all over the world. That's expensive. We have six producers, and they work very hard. That adds to what we need to do in order to try to meet your expectations. So we've made it easy to help. You can donate $10 by texting KCRW to 20222. Do that if you will. Let's now start the show, and thanks.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Pope Francis, God and Money. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The new Roman Catholic pontiff shared his 77th birthday today with homeless people, one of whom brought his dog inside the Vatican. This weekend, Pope Francis denied right-wing accusations that he's a Marxist, defending his criticism of capitalism and his focus on serving the poor. Is one of the world's most influential leaders pitting his church against the free market? Is he inserting religion into the realm of politics? Or is he emphasizing the teachings of Jesus Christ, who warned against trying to serve both God and money? Today's talking point, GlaxoSmithKline and Dollars for Docs. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The leader of the Roman Catholic Church says free enterprise capitalism is a new tyranny, and he's called for a new focus on serving the poor. We'll hear different views on what Pope Francis means about politics, economics, and religion. Today's talking point, a major drug company, GlaxoSmithKline, says it won't pay doctors to promote its products anymore. Will the rest of Big Pharma follow suit? First, this news update. A federal judge came down hard yesterday on the National Security Agency's collection of billions of America's telephone records, calling it a likely violation of the Constitution. But Judge Richard Leon stayed his own injunction against the NSA, setting off what's likely to be a long debate about the law and national security. That's the specialty of Professor Stephen Vladek at the American University Law School. Good to have you on our program.
Oh, nice to be back with you, Warren.
What's the constitutional issue?
Well, so the constitutional issue in a nutshell is the claim that when the government is collecting our data on our phone records without a warrant, without probable cause, without any kind of individualized suspicion, it's violating the search and seizure clause of the Fourth Amendment, and that it really has to have at least something more before it collects our records on such a mass suspicionless scale.
So what would the injunction mean?
Well, interestingly, I mean, the Judge Leon both enjoined the program and then stayed his decision. So at least practically and immediately, the decision has no real impact. The government can continue to do tomorrow what it could do yesterday. I think the much larger point here is the symbolism of it, that we finally have at least one federal judge who has suggested that there are serious legal problems with the metadata program and that we really do need a larger national conversation and potentially resolution by the Supreme Court of the ultimate legality of what the NSA is up to.
The injunction would mean, though, if it were enforced, that the NSA couldn't collect the records anymore.
It would mean that they couldn't collect the records at least on this mass suspicionless scale. Of course, nothing would stop them from doing what the FBI is already empowered to do on a daily basis, which is to go to the phone companies once they have any kind of individualized suspicion and ask for the records at that point. But I think the other piece of this is whether, if the injunction remains in place, if the district court is affirmed, we'll finally see Congress impelled to, you know, pursue at least some of the reform proposals with regard to the metadata program that have been introduced in the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I think that's the real sort of end game here, is who's going to get there first, Congress or the courts.
So the Justice Department is likely to go to the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. That's the second highest court in the nation. Does that make it likely that it'll end up in the U.S. Supreme Court?
You know, Warren, as you know, it's really hard to predict because a lot of it will depend on what the D.C. Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court here in Washington, holds. If they, you know, find a way to sort of affirm or reverse on narrow grounds and send it back to the trial court, it probably won't go to the Supreme Court right away. This is a very early stage in litigation. But I do think that one way or the other, this question of whether Congress has authorized and the Constitution allows such mass collection of data without any individualized suspicion, that's bound to get to the Supreme Court sooner or later. I think it's just a question of which case raises the question, when it gets there.
Once again, you said this would be a long process. It's ending longer and longer the more we talk. If, in fact, the FBI already has the power to do what the NSA is doing under certain circumstances, would that tend to be important in the appeals process and lengthen the whole matter?
It might, but, the NSA's position has been throughout this litigation that even if the FBI is allowed to act reactively once they have information on a suspect and then go to the phone company, that the sort of nature of intelligence gathering and the importance of being able to act quickly are the justifications for allowing the NSA to basically build this database and have it at the ready when that time comes, as opposed to only then being able to go out to the phone companies. So I think there is a hard question here to be asked and hopefully answered about just how necessary it is for the NSA to collect these records at the outset, before there's any kind of individualized showing. Whether that affects how the courts ultimately resolve this case remains to be seen.
We're talking about the phone companies, as you indicated. The president today is meeting with some of the very high-level officials from Silicon Valley, some of the companies that took out a open letter and printed it in newspapers saying they wanted to get this NSA thing under control because they felt that their reputations were at risk. Is that what the president is talking about them with at the White House?
Well, it's funny. It's so hard to keep track of all the programs. For the most part, the Silicon Valley companies are there about a different program, which we know as the PRISM program, which is the ability of the NSA to basically go directly to these companies with regard to their overseas servers and intercept the content of communications, at least when the targets are non-citizens outside the United States. So it's technically a different program, but Warren, it is the same larger optical point, which is, these are corporations that have bottom lines. And the more that it looks like they are facilitating mass government surveillance of their customers, whether their customers are here or overseas, the more that we may start to expect that they, as much as anybody else, will be pushing the president and pushing Congress to scale back these programs.
So is Congress then, is it getting more and more pressure, not just from the tech companies, but perhaps from the phone companies as well, and from a lot of other people as well, privacy organizations and others. Do you think Congress is going to ultimately have to act?
I mean, I think there's no question that Congress will ultimately have to act. I think the million-dollar question is what that action will look like. There are a series of competing proposals right now, some of which are actually fairly significant and substantial reforms of the NSA's authorities, some of which are really window dressing. And so I think the question simply becomes whether this pressure is going to produce not just some congressional action, but meaningful congressional action in a way that, one way or the other, puts these programs onto far more carefully circumscribed legal footing.
Stephen Ludic at American University Law School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, Pope Francis, God and Money, on To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Today on his 77th birthday, Pope Francis invited a group of homeless people inside the Vatican. One met the pontiff while holding a dog. It was a visual example of his informality and his modest lifestyle in contrast to what he's called the idolatry of money. In a recent statement, he said it is vital that government leaders and financial leaders take heed and broaden their horizons, working to ensure that all citizens have dignified work, education, and health care. He's called capitalism a new tyranny. That's led Rush Limbaugh to call Francis a Marxist and to comments like this from Stuart Varney of Fox News.
I personally do not want my spiritual life mixed up with my political life. I go to church to save my soul. It's got nothing to do with my vote. Pope Francis has linked the two. He's offered direct criticism of a specific political system. He's characterized negatively that system. I think he wants to influence my politics.
Mark Silk is director of the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He's author of Unsecular Media, Making News of Religion in America. Mark Silk, good to have you with us.
Delighted to be here, Warren.
And the Pope has certainly been making news of religion. Has he been linking politics and religion?
Well, he's certainly been linking a lot of public issues to religion. And in fact, he thinks religion, his religion, Christianity, is very much about public issues.
Did Jesus feel the same way?
Well, there's certainly a lot of people, including the Pope, who think that Jesus had quite a lot to say about helping the least among us, poor people. He also said the poor will always be with us. Jesus said a lot of things, but I think there's been a central concern about helping people in need in not only Christianity, but in the three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and the Pope certainly speaks to that.
Is it unusual, however, for a Pope to be as specifically critical of a system like capitalism as Pope Francis has been?
Well, we can go back to the end of the 19th century famous encyclical of Pope Leo XIII in 1891 called Rerum Novarum, which was quite critical of capitalism, and indeed the whole Catholic Church history going back to condemnations of usury in the Middle Ages and so on can be seen as, you know, taking a somewhat skeptical view about money and money making for its own ends. And there's been a continuation of that social teaching through the 20th century. But I think the emphasis that Pope Francis has placed on this, both in his own life and how he talks about the church, how he talks about evangelism, that really changes the discourse, or has changed the discourse. And I don't think one can pretend that somehow there's nothing new under the sun here.
What about the most recent popes prior to Francis? Their major enemy has been communism.
Well, they have. Certainly that was true with John Paul II, who was the Polish pope and presided over the end of the Soviet Empire, if one wants to put it that way. Benedict did have some important statements, which were taken by some as critical of capitalism, and indeed one of the sort of notable Catholic intellectuals on the right, George Weigel, tried to argue that some of the anti-capitalist stuff in what he had to say was actually sort of put in by gnomes in the curia, but no one quite bought that.
So he was, however, critical of capitalism, but not as explicitly, not as extensively as Pope Francis, who has been called, once again, a Marxist and was asked about that in a lengthy interview and said he knows a lot of Marxists and think they're good people, even though he thinks that the ideology of Marxism is wrong. So he's confronting this right on.
Oh, I think he is. There was some debate when he was first elected about what his position on liberation theology was and is, and that's certainly a piece of theology that has been accused of Marxism. But I think what's interesting about Francis in this respect, or one of the things that is that his willingness to sort of engage in the kind of discussion that people in the political realm have. I mean, in this exhortation to the faithful, he talks critically about trickle-down economics. I mean, that's Reagan-era language. That's language that we use today. And so it's really an invitation, he's picking up the invitation to talk about politics and economics the way the secular world does.
Again, Mark Silk is at the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College in Hartford. Chris Lowney is a former Jesuit seminarian. He later worked as managing director at the banking firm of J.P. Morgan. He's author now of Heroic Leadership and most recently of Pope Francis, Why He Leads the Way He Leads. Chris Lowney, good to have you on our program.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the chance.
What's your take on what the Pope has been saying?
I think I would put it first in a broader context. You know, as I see it, he's really trying to engineer a massive culture change in the Catholic Church. he wouldn't use those words, culture change, massive culture change. But, for example, I think his vision is a church that itself is much more simple. His own lifestyle is one example of that. A church that is much more outgoing, much more energetic in its outreach, trying to spread its message rather than kind of hunkered down and turned in on itself. And finally, to the point of our discussion here, a church that is very squarely identified with the poor, with the marginalized, with people who are excluded from society. And if that means from time to time his comments are going to bear on economics, then so be it.
So he is then trying to make a difference in terms of politics and economics.
Yeah, or I might put it this way. You know, I think he is not imagining himself as an economist or a technocrat, but to use something he has said as a kind of a window into where I think he's going. You know, at one point he said something like, if the stock market drops 10 points in a country, that's major news. If some homeless person dies in the street, that's not news at all. So I think in a way what he's trying to say is, look, the point is not ultimately that we have a capitalist system. The point is that if we become so obsessed in our lives and concerns that the only thing that matters is what's in it for me, my portfolio, how much money I make, and we overlook the very real suffering and the fact that there are people who have inadequate education, inadequate health care, who can't really use their talents, then something is very badly wrong with our priorities as a society.
In the Daily Beast, you wrote an article saying that the Pope has gone easy on the wealthy, and you pointed to that phrase, trickle-down economics. What did you mean?
Yeah, what I meant was this, that so he, as Mark pointed out, he recently issued a very long exhortation is the word the Vatican uses. And, some portions of that dealt with economics and what a just society would look like and so on. And in the course of that, he used the phrase trickle-down economics. And that disappointed me a little bit, but maybe not for the reasons people might expect. What I thought was too bad about that was by using a phrase like that, very simplistic, a kind of a caricature, it just enabled us immediately to lapse into ideological flag waving and tossing around these vague talking points that don't really have a lot of substance to them, you know. And it gave us all an excuse to go back into our ideological trenches and just talk about democratic economic vision as opposed to Republican economic vision. And really, whereas I think his point was more fundamental and more transcendent than that. In other words, human beings in the Catholic vision of the world, every human being has the right to flourish.
So you think he undermined his own message?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's my point, and that's I'm by no means broadsiding his full document, but I think he could have avoided that particular kind of phrase and forced us to confront much more squarely and much more directly the core issue he's trying to put on the table, which is what is a just society? In the 21st century, do we really feel we're doing the best we can if, for example, millions of American children live in poverty, or billions of people around the world don't have enough to eat? I mean, is that really the best we can do? And now you go on in civil society and have the debate about how much of that has to do with matters of charity, how much of it has to do with economic conditions, how much of it has to do with how business people run businesses.
Chris Lowney, once again, author of Pope Francis, Why He Leads the Way He Leads. Jerry Mueller is a professor of history at the Catholic University of America. He's author of The Mind and the Market, Capitalism in Western Thought. Professor Mueller, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you.
You have been critical of the Pope's statement in a very different way. Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, I'm only talking about the economic portions of this recent papal exhortation, which are a relatively small proportion of the total document, though they're the part that seems to have gotten the most press attention. And I should also note that I'm not speaking as a Catholic, since I'm not a Catholic, though it's been my pleasure to teach at a Catholic university for a lot of my academic life.
Okay, thanks for that.
But it seems to me that the remarks on economic matters in this papal exhortation seem to reflect more of an outcry of the heart than of the head. That is to say, it's full of sentiments and slogans, but I don't think there's much that can be called analysis or conceptual clarity. And while it contains a number of formulations that many morally sensitive people would agree with, like the potential pitfalls of consumerism, it also includes a lot of formulations that, frankly, are radical in tone and their implications without seeming to have thought out what those implications might be. Take a statement like, and here I quote directly, "The socioeconomic system is unjust at its root." Much of the description is, of economic matters seems bereft of a basic understanding of the economics of competitive capitalism, which Lord knows has its problems. But the depiction here is remarkably one-sided and seems actually based on the implicit assumption that wealth is a kind of zero-sum game and that the poor are poor because the rich are rich. And indeed, he says quite explicitly that the rich feed upon the poor. And that, I think, as I say, reflects a kind of pre-economic understanding of what actually happens in a competitive capitalist economy. There's also a confusion in the document of poverty, the issue of poverty, with the issue of inequality, which is a different issue. So there's no recognition, for example, that poverty in the last 25 years has been declining for millions of people in recent decades. Actually, about a billion people in the last 25 years around the world have moved from what you might call extreme poverty of making less than $1.25 per person per day into better circumstances. And the global poverty rate has actually been more or less cut in half in the last 25 or 30 years. And while in this economic portion the Pope praises improvements in health care and communications, he doesn't make any link between those improvements in communications and in health care and the capitalist economies that he then goes on to condemn a few paragraphs later. So when he writes things like today everything comes under the laws of competition and the survival of the fittest, where the powerful feed upon the powerless, that's a direct quote. You'll notice that there's an equation here of competition with the powerful feeding upon the powerless, whereas actually competitive economies are the ones in which the powerful can't feed on the powerless but have to cater to the powerless to try to get them to buy goods and services. And so economically successful people like Bill Gates or the founder of Microsoft or Larry Page, the co-founder of Google, these people made a lot of money by providing goods that a lot of people want to buy. Or take another rich person in our society, Warren Buffett, who invests the money of many people who are trying to make themselves better off and gets rewarded for it.
So you think indirectly then the Pope is critical of those people who are, in fact, according to your analysis, getting rich by providing a service that people want?
I think there's no recognition in the I think the problem is deeper than that, Warren. I think there's no recognition in the document that people get rich by providing goods and services that other people want.
Quickly, Chris Lowney, we have only a moment before we need to go to a break, but I'm just interested in your response, once again, as a former Jesuit, a former director of the banking firm of J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with some of what Jerry said about, you know, the economics that's there is really not deep enough, and I think it tends to draw Francis away from the deeper message. But on the other hand, he says in the document, business is a noble profession, and I think somebody like Bill Gates would be exhibit A, even in Pope Francis' mind, of how it can work well. Somebody who creates employment, who generates wealth, who pays a fair share of taxes, who distributes a surplus. That's what we want.
As I said, we need to go to a break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation on our talking point later. GlaxoSmithKline calls a halt to dollars for doctors. We'll find out what that means. Will the rest of Big Pharma follow suit? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcast you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
We're on Only Back with To The Point, talking today about Pope Francis and the controversy that he has stirred by comments recently, particularly about economics in his exhortation, as it is called, by the church, where he said such things as the socioeconomic system of capitalism is unjust at its root, where the powerful feed on the powerless, and making the point that we need to pay more attention to the poor. Back to Chris Lowney once again. Again, our a former Jesuit who went into the banking business. I'm just interested in this context, of how you managed to go from being a Jesuit seminarian to a managing director at a banking firm, and now to being a writer of such books as Pope Francis, Why He Leads the Way He Leads. It seems to me that some of the things we're talking about must have been important to you in your career.
Yes, yeah. So I joined the Jesuits right after high school, so I was 18 years old, and Jesuits have an incredibly long formation before they're priests. So I stayed for 6 years. I was only about halfway to being a priest when I realized that my path in life was not celibate life as a priest, and the last thing I was doing as a Jesuit was teaching economics, and therefore I was lucky enough to end up in one of these Morgan training programs. And, you know, I might say, going back to this document, one of the things the Pope says is that we don't need representatives in the church who are sourpusses or who look like they're coming from a funeral or who are like Lent without Easter. And, you know, I mean, I realized that I was not going to end up being a happy person. That's not a comment on the Catholic Church or priesthood, but just my own path in life. And so I left, and I was lucky enough to work at Morgan for about 17 years. But, you know, ultimately in the scheme of life, I felt, okay, look, I don't want to be 70 years old and feel like the only thing I did was sat and collected bonus checks at J.P. Morgan. And now I spend time writing and especially trying to think about leadership. And that was the lens through which I wanted to look at this Pope, you know, this leadership style that really has galvanized people right from that first evening when he showed up on the balcony and said, why don't you bless me before I bless you? You know, very powerful kinds of messages and gestures that he's managed to put across right from the very first evening.
And Jerry Mueller, back to you at Catholic University. You're a professor there. You were careful to say you are not yourself a Catholic. But do you agree with Chris Lowney that the Pope's basic message is one that is, in fact, Christian?
Sure, it's Christian, but there are many forms of Christian reflection on these sort of issues, and indeed there are many forms of Catholic reflection. And in many respects, this latest papal exhortation is continuous with certain elements of modern Catholic social thought, especially the fact that modern Catholic social thought from the time of these late 19th century encyclicals tends to be both anti-socialist, pro-private property, but suspicious of competition. And it's actually very difficult to reconcile capitalism with a suspicion of competition, because that competition brings about what Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction, and both the creative side and the destructive side are true. But that's always an issue that the Catholic Church has in its official social documents and in its practice has wrestled with. I think, though, in terms of economic understanding, I hate to say this, but I think the document marks a step back, say, from John Paul II's major encyclical on the topic from 1991, Centimus Annus, which also had some suspicions and perfectly legitimate criticisms of capitalism, but recognize the role of creation and the creation of new wealth and the use of the mind through the market and so on, in a way that, to be honest, this document seems almost entirely to ignore.
Let us introduce a religious scholar who comes from yet a different point of view. Reza Aslan was raised as a Christian evangelical. He is now a Muslim, but he is again, as I said, a religious scholar, and he's author of a new book called Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, a very close reading of the New Testament. Reza Aslan, good to have you on our program again.
Thanks, Warren.
What's your take on what Pope Francis is saying? Do you think that it is new and different and revolutionary? Does it, as Professor Mueller says, come more from the heart than the head? Has he misunderstood economics, or is he applying what Jesus said?
Well, I can't really speak to whether he's misunderstanding economics because I am not an economist, but I am an expert on the Bible, and what I can tell you is that Pope Francis's teachings on unchecked capitalism and the sort of catastrophe of the market in the present day is very much in line with the teachings of Jesus, and very much in line, of course, with the Jesuits. Pope Francis is the first Jesuit pope, and the Jesuits take this whole preferential option for the poor thing pretty seriously, Warren. In a way, the message of Jesus, the social teachings of of Jesus, is predicated upon this very concept of the reversal of the social order. And so, yes, there have been a number of criticisms of the Pope, particularly from the right wing in the United States, people like Limbaugh and Crosshammer, who Limbaugh even went so far as to call him a Marxist. But nevertheless, the fact of the matter is that this apostolic exhortation and the sort of very critical, even condemnatory comments of the sort of free market capitalism that has, created such destruction over the last few years around the world is deeply a part of the teachings of the historical Jesus.
What about the idea we just heard from Professor Mueller that capitalism encourages competition, and competition is in fact the way in which people get what they want and need, and it has in fact managed to improve the status of people around the world? You said we have a catastrophe of the market, but what about the basic principles involved and the history of the marketplace in making a better life for people?
Well, I think the criticism of the Pope isn't just of capitalism per se. It's of the notion, as he himself put it, that the market is amoral, that capitalism as a force for, in and of itself, should just be left alone, that it can be a force for good, that it doesn't need to be regulated, that there doesn't need to be any control over the markets whatsoever. That's the prevailing economic theory, certainly in the United States, and that is the prevailing economic theory that has led to the global financial collapse that we have experienced. And so what cannot be denied, regardless of all the social goods that one can talk about that capitalism has resulted around the world, what cannot be denied is that right now the gap between the very rich and the very poor is the highest it's been in generations. And that's partly to do with this kind of unchecked, unregulated sense of free market capitalism that the Pope was criticizing.
Let me go back to Jerry Mueller, our professor at Catholic University, not himself a Catholic. Let me make that very clear once again. How do you respond to what we just heard?
Well, I think it's a caricature of the actual ideologies and practice of people in advanced capitalist societies. I don't think you would find very many businessmen who would tell you that we live in an unregulated, unchecked capitalist economy. That is to say, to the extent that it's checked both by forces of competition and it's checked by various kinds of government regulations, which are actually very extensive. And the number of people who, there is a name for people who believe that, you know, an unchecked market is in itself a good thing. And those are libertarians, but that's a small percentage of people who either support capitalism or are active in it or think about it in advanced industrial societies. And it's true that we've had major problems of the financial system. But again, you've got to see this. And there are other major problems, some of which the Pope alludes to. There are people who are marginalized in capitalist societies in that the value of labor, especially the value of unskilled labor, is going down. And so the value of their labor is going down, and they often can't make enough in the marketplace to support themselves, which is why, at least in well-to-do capitalist societies, there's also a welfare state that provides a cushion for those people. So I think we should not deal with caricatures of these societies, but rather look at the reality. And in terms of actual expenditure as opposed to income, the gap between the top, say, 20% in the United States and the bottom 20% actually hasn't changed very much in the last 20 or 30 years. Again, the level of their pre-tax and pre-transfer income, the level of inequality there has increased. But when you take into consideration the effect of taxation, the effect of government transfer payments, and when you look at what people actually spend, the gap between them, while very substantial, hasn't increased that radically.
Okay, we're getting more into economics than we are
religion,
and I suppose that's inevitable in this conversation, mm-hmm. given what the Pope has said about it. Reza Aslan, you're entitled to respond to that. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I mean, listen, I'm certain that most business people, in other words, people at the top of the social ladder, think that there's plenty regulation and plenty control over capitalism. And I'm certain that most of the people at the bottom of that ladder would disagree. But nevertheless, I mean, again, you're right that this is a matter of theology, not a matter of economics. And the Pope's theology is, frankly, in this case, immaculate. You know, we have this tendency, and this is fairly normal because, of course, the Christ of faith can be whatever you want the Christ of faith to be. The fastest growing Protestant movement in the United States is the prosperity gospel, this notion that Jesus actually wants you to be materially wealthy. And so you have preachers like Joel Osteen and T.D. Jakes making tens of millions of dollars in profits preaching this incredibly fast-growing gospel. So truly, the gospel message can be transformed and be sort of infinitely malleable and can shape whatever your own particular economic or political viewpoints are. But insofar as, you know, the teachings of the historical Jesus, it's quite an uncomfortable teaching. Jesus was not about equality, unfortunately. He was about the reversal of the social order. It's the hungry that shall be fed and the fed that shall go hungry. The poor shall be made rich and the rich shall be made poor. The first shall be last, the last shall be first. That is a message that is not very popular. It wasn't very popular in his time, and it wouldn't be very popular in our time. But it is the message that the Pope, as the head of the Catholic Church, as the representative of Jesus on earth, and then again, I have to say one more time, as a Jesuit, it is a message that I think he feels very close to his heart, and it's one that's going to really define his papacy, and I think that's a good thing.
Chris Lowney, back to you again, a former Jesuit seminarian who also worked at J.P. Morgan. You said you thought the Pope had undermined his own message in some respects. Very interested in your take on what Reza Aslan says about how Jesuits feel about these matters and also the question of the uncomfortable teaching. Are people misunderstanding what the Pope's saying?
Yeah. So let me start with the uncomfortable teaching first, and then I'll mention the Jesuit angle. So, you know, economies are incredibly complex, and I think this rich discussion illustrates that. I mean, I worked in Asia for J.P. Morgan. I saw, not personally, but literally in those years, tens of millions of people lifted themselves out of poverty just because markets became open and started to function well. So, you know, markets do wonderful, wonderful things. On the other hand, I also saw and knew that there were people working in factories in utterly inhumane conditions. You know, and we've seen the kind of spectacular fallout when speculative bubbles burst. So, you know, markets are complex, and you know, I think it's for the Pope to get dragged into the middle of the economics of it did for me slightly undermine his message, because absolutely crystal clear and fundamental in Catholic teaching is that all humans have fundamental dignity and should have the right to flourish. And if we have more than we need and others don't have enough to get by, then it's fundamentally sinful not to respond to that in some way. And how we respond has something to do with individual effort, with charity, something to do with the conscience of business people, and something to do with how we structure our economies. Very quickly on the Jesuit piece of it, I think Rissa is quite right. You know, the history of the Jesuit order over the last half century, let's say, is that there came a growing conscience. There's a lot of Jesuits working in Latin America, in India, in Africa, sort of feeling, you know, look, if the only thing we're doing is educating well-off people to perpetuate the status quo, people who aren't fundamentally concerned with trying to create a more just society, then look, we're not. What kind of a labor is this? And so the focus of a part of the Jesuit, the way they did education, very much over the recent decades, emphasized the creation of a more just society as fundamental aspect of somebody's religious beliefs, as of one's practice of faith. So I think Rissa is completely right there that that would be a little bit in the Pope's DNA and culture, as mind you, it would be if somebody who was in Argentina, frankly, and saw the widespread poverty of big pockets of Latin America.
Let me go back to our first guest, and we haven't heard since the first part of our program, Mark Silk, who's director of the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life and professor of religion in public life at Trinity College in Hartford. Is this the kind of conversation that, do you think, the Pope wants people to have? And what about the reaction, particularly from conservative Catholics who may feel very uncomfortable about the message, as Reza Aslan suggested, even though it may be a message that sounds a lot like Jesus Christ?
Well, I suspect the Pope wouldn't be unhappy with it. He's pretty relaxed about conversations.
He seems to be.
I think he has taken a pretty clear aim at conservative Catholic apologists for capitalism, if I can put it that way. And that is to say, at the end of the, or if you listen to the rhetoric of people who are apologists for the system, it does tend to talk in terms of the magic of the market. You do have very active people in the world, including ones that have just given $1 million to Catholic University, who are out there in states across the country urging legislation that hurts the ability of labor unions to organize, that undermines various ways in which we have structured our economies to regulate it. That's a conversation that we have in our society. But the Pope is pushing back against some of that rhetoric. Now, one can disapprove about sort of feeling like he's just joining the fray, and I'm sympathetic to, the view that we don't want to just throw cliches back and forth at each other. But it's pretty clear that he understands that there's been a rhetoric of all we have to do is liberate the wonders of capitalism and it will solve all problems, and he doesn't like it.
Is he going to be a supporter of liberation theology, something that was sort of alluded to, I think, by Chris Lowney just a moment ago?
Well, he has had lots of relations with people who are liberationists. He talked to them as Pope. I think we're talking about differences of degree and the extent to which some of its most strongest supporters have embraced what certainly looked like a straight-up Marxist analysis. He's separated himself from that, but in terms of strong feelings of, as they say in the church, a preferential option for the poor, he's totally there.
Okay. I'm sorry that that's all the time we have. Obviously, this is a conversation that could go on for a lot longer and no doubt will on our subsequent programs. I hope all of you will be able to join us again. Mark Silk, again, at the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College. Chris Lowney, author of Pope Francis, Why He Leads the Way He Leads. Jerry Mueller at Catholic University, his book, The Mind of the Market, Capitalism and Western Thought, and Reza Aslan, a religious scholar, author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. We'll be hearing a lot more about and from Pope Francis in days to come. It's been standard practice for drug companies to pay doctors for promoting their products in speaking engagements and elsewhere, making some doctors rich, but raising ethical questions. Now, GlaxoSmithKline says it's not going to do that anymore. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Well, and I'll be back with today's talking point. GlaxoSmithKline is the sixth largest drug company, maker of Advair, Loveza, and other products. Today's announcement that it won't pay doctors as marketers anymore may be evolutionary rather than revolutionary. That's according to Charles Ornstein, who's senior reporter at ProPublica and past president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists. Charles Ornstein, Charlie, always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Tell us, first of all, about the relationship between doctors and drug companies traditionally. What's wrong with it?
Well, this is a relationship that's gone back decades, as you probably know. There's been a close relationship. The pharmaceutical industry relies on physicians to conduct research on their behalf, to provide advice about which drugs they should conduct research on, which drugs they should market, how they should do their marketing. And then finally, doctors have been known to go and deliver promotional talks on behalf of those companies. But those promotional talks have been pretty controversial. People have probably remember a flood of lawsuits that have been filed against well-known pharmaceutical companies, Pfizer and Merck and Eli Lilly, and companies alleging that they improperly marketed their drugs. And these companies have paid hundreds of millions and in some cases billions of dollars to settle these allegations that they weren't marketing their drugs properly. And so that sort of changed the course of the way in which these companies interact with doctors.
What were the – you say that they lost some of the suits, I take it. So what were they found to have done? In what ways was the promotion inappropriate or illegal?
Well, they settled the suits to avoid a trial. So all of these companies settled them. But they were accused of promoting the drugs for unapproved uses. So if a drug, for instance, is approved for use for a certain condition, they were marketing it and encouraging doctors to promote it for use in other conditions. This is well known in the case of antipsychotics, which are used to treat schizophrenia and bipolar disease. And pharmaceutical companies were found to have marketed them for use in children, even though they didn't have approval to do so. And they paid a hefty sum for that. But in one of the things that they did in settling the suits is that they agreed that they would begin publicly releasing the names and amounts of their payments to doctors. And so that's what you've been seeing in recent years.
And ProPublica has a Dollars for Docs database, I took it.
That's right. On our website, so if you go to ProPublica.org/docdollars, you can type in the name of your doctor and look to see whether he or she has received payments from 15 drug companies that are currently disclosing this information. We have 2 million payments and $2 billion that have been disclosed. So people, I think, are interested in whether or not their doctors have received money from the pharmaceutical industry. It's not necessarily a sign if it's a good doctor or a bad doctor, but it is something that you can ask questions on. Go ahead.
So back to today's announcement by GlaxoSmithKline that they're not going to pay for promotional appearances and other types of marketing by doctors. Why do you call it evolutionary rather than revolutionary?
Well, as we were looking at our database, what we saw is that GlaxoSmithKline has been reducing the amount of money it spends on physician speakers ever since it started reporting this information. So back in 2009, it was spending $15 million a quarter on paid promotional talks. That dropped to $13 million in 2010, $6 million in 2011, and down to $2.5 million each quarter in 2012. So this was on the decline. It had declined more than 80% for this company. And while you saw some other companies that have held sort of their level steady or even increased it, for Glaxo it had been going down. So it was not as if this is a company that was holding steady and is sort of pulling the rug out. All signs sort of pointed to that they were much less reliant on physician speakers than in the past.
Given the history of lawsuits and settlements that you gave us, are other companies likely to do the same thing?
It's hard to know. Some companies are very reliant on physician speakers, and I think you'll see companies treading very cautiously. At the same time, you know, the scrutiny of the pharmaceutical industry is very high. Beginning next year, there's a law called the Physician Payment Sunshine Act, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, which will require every pharmaceutical and medical device maker to report all payments to doctors. So that will become public beginning next September. When that happens, I think you'll see a lot of patients who are going to look at this information and are going to ask their doctors questions, and that's going to, I think, trigger even more soul searching.
Glaxo also says it will no longer pay sales representatives based on the amount, the number of prescriptions that doctors make for their drugs. How important is that?
Well, I think that what you saw is a compensation system that was set up in the pharmaceutical companies that encouraged sales representatives to be the primary sort of indication was how many pills they sold. They tracked their payments to doctors as far as what their return on investment was. They tracked their payments to sales representatives the same way. Instead of looking at whether or not they provided, you know, accurate information, useful information, it was all about the numbers. And I think taking a step back and sort of reassessing the way in which they provide compensation both to doctors and to sales representatives does make a lot of sense.
So is this market then changing? Are we going to see fewer abuses of the kind that have led to these big settlements?
Well, there's been a lot of changes in the recent years. For example, you don't see pharmaceutical companies going around and handing out pens anymore. That's been banned under a voluntary code of conduct. So things are changing. You don't see these fancy trips to Aruba or the Caribbean islands. But, you know, Glaxo's been under a lot of scrutiny. It's under investigation in China for bribing doctors there to prescribe their drugs and using travel agencies to sort of cover up the money. So there was a lot of additional pressure being put on GlaxoSmithKline that perhaps is not on some of the other drug companies right now.
So public scrutiny then is having an impact certainly on Glaxo, but would it also, do you think, discourage the others from doing similar kinds of things?
We've talked to a lot of doctors, and doctors say that they don't like their names being out there. They don't like it when patients can do a Google search and see all the payments and interactions they've had with the pharmaceutical industry. So if that's a guide, I do think that you're going to find that some doctors are not interested. And at the same time, medical schools, prominent academic medical schools, and teaching hospitals don't want their doctors to be paid promotional speakers. Their view is that doctors are supposed to be doctors and researchers, not white coat marketers. So there's a lot of pressure on physicians to not engage in paid promotional activity as well.
Okay, Charles Ornstein again with the ProPublica and that website, ProPublica.org/dollars, if you want to check up on your doctor. Charlie, good to have you back on our program. Thanks a lot for being
Thanks,
with us.
Thanks, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.